Hi there, I'm Alex Cook, the CEO of Phase 3 Search, and welcome to the Phase 3 Biotech Leadership Podcast. This podcast is a platform for the highly successful leaders in our industry to share their wisdom, tools, tips, tricks, and routines in order to help develop the next generation of leaders coming through. It's also an opportunity to refocus and to make sure that we're all centered on the mission of expediting the launch of new therapies in order to save and impact the lives of patients all over the world. Without further ado, we're going to jump straight into our latest interview. Hi there, and welcome to the latest episode of the Phase 3 Biotech Leadership Podcast. I'm really happy to be able to welcome Kristin Gustafsson, or KG, to join us for this episode. And I'd be ever so grateful, KG, if you can give us a bit of an overview of who you are and what leadership positions you've held.
Thank you for having me, Alex. It's great to be here. I go by KG. I have been in the biotech industry for about 20 years now. I have primarily held the head of HR role, different titles along the way, VP of HR, SVP of HR, etc. I'm currently the SVP of HR and Facilities at Turnstone Biologics in New York City.
Fantastic. And we're here, obviously, to discuss leadership and that side of things. And obviously, my personal belief is that HR is kind of the ultimate custodian of all things culture. And I really, really intrigued to kind of get your take on different elements. So I think where I'd like to start is to really look at, what does leadership mean to you, and how do you personally define it?
I think that answer has evolved as I have grown up in this industry especially. I think leadership started in the early days of the buck stops with me. What answers can I have for people that report to me? And it's really evolved into a much more holistic leadership approach around things like, you know, a good leader to me is humble, a good leader has compassion, and a good leader has courage. And so I think those are the things that are just a solid foundation of great leadership.
Sure. And are those the three things that you would have uniquely selected, or are they generalities, or are there other things which you would kind of, if you had to just pick three?
I think for me, it's what resonates with me. I know, obviously, in the human resources role, there are a number of leadership styles that I've seen with both folks that I've worked with today and also in the past. I think for me, there's no one right style, because leadership, it's kind of a personal of, you know, what you're gravitating to. I think when we think about leaders that we have worked with and reported to, there aren't core pieces. I like to kind of pull out what resonates with me, but I think that I couldn't say here are the three for every person out there, because it's an individual approach.
Sure. And I guess an interesting thing about that is, having worked with lots of different leaders and seen lots of different styles, there's the ability to learn from what you liked, but I'm sure that there's also the ability to learn from what you didn't like. So
absolutely.
Have there been things that maybe you've come across and you've gone, yeah, you know what, when it's my turn, I'm not doing that. And it'd be interesting to know what those things are as well.
You know, there was a role that I took to expand my position. I wanted more than just HR. And so sales operations was added, some other things under my remit. And the job itself was amazing, but the leader at that organization that I reported to, it's that proverbial micromanager. It's the person that will say, I would love to delegate this to you, and then check in every 5 minutes on work product. Someone that actually isn't an expert in certain areas, but has just enough knowledge to be dangerous. And that type of leader, when they're really kind of encroaching on that departmental freedom, if you will, is something that just my personality absolutely has an allergic reaction to.
Sure. So how does that translate maybe to you and your own teams then? Because
I'm sure there's a very fine balance. You can't just, you know, point people in a direction and let them go. But also, you know, you at the same time, you definitely don't want to micromanage them. So how do you handle that delineation?
Yeah, I do think there's a need in leadership, and there's a model that's been around for years called situational leadership, and it's all about meeting people where they're at. So if you're meeting someone early in their career that needs that telling and that direction and that micromanagement, that may be a leadership style that you need to use for that individual. But I think as people progress in their career, when they're not only running departments, but also, you know, part of running organizations, I think that's when you're moving along that continuum into coaching and delegation. And so I think that's how you address that. If you have 6 direct reports, 3 are very experienced, 3 are not, you do adjust your approach with them. To help them, again, kind of get acclimated, what the needs are, what the expectations are. But I think that's also, you know, something in watching your team of how much or how little of that tool do you use.
Sure. I heard something recently that made me smile, which is that somebody said, if you really want to know how good your team is, just go on vacation.
Exactly. Exactly. And those that you've delegated to probably don't even know that you're gone.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, hopefully.
Yes.
So, I mean, with that being said, then, in terms of your own leadership philosophy, what are the cornerstones that you use or you believe make up your leadership philosophy?
You know, my philosophy, I don't think had a name to it until a few years back. There was a book that came out around servant leadership. And there was something about that model, about that book, that really resonated with me. And I think my philosophy has always been this idea of, how can I help? How can I help the individual? How can I help the organization? And so I really think that for me, that philosophy of servant leadership and really helping through others is what, it doesn't happen every day, but what I like to kind of root and have that foundation is in the last few years, especially.
Excellent. And if you were to think about maybe your teams, and the teams you've built, and they've, you know, I know UKG, so I know there've been quite a few. Are there common traits that run between those teams and traits that you've almost taken from your philosophy and you try to impart to them?
There has, you know, my track record in biotech, thank God, knock on wood, whatever it is, have been just meteoric rise, you know, growth type companies. And, you know, the likes of an Intercept, a Kite, in some cases we're hiring hundreds of people a month to, you know, meet our PDUFA date, our needs internally, et cetera. So I would say one of the, you know, if I had to pick ways to describe how I've led my teams, there's a theme around innovate, execute, and speed. And those three areas have helped not only, again, drive the function, and usually a lot of that in a very high growth company is around recruiting, but also leading the organization around that growth. And so I think those would be three words if I had to pick some that would describe the nuance that plays through all of the teams that have reported to me because of those different high growth, fast growth scenarios would be innovate, execute, speed.
And in terms of now, I'm obviously talking to the polished version of KG.
Yes.
and I'm sure that years ago, there were maybe a couple of rough edges here or there. So were there areas that you had to personally really work at? Or was there maybe, you know, leaders in the past which kind of came to you and said, look, we know you're great, but you really need to sort this out. And I think it would be, you know, fascinating to understand what one of those things was, maybe what the situation was, how you took that feedback and then, you know, really kind of worked with it.
Yeah, you know, one of the things as I was, you know, as you're growing and things are fast moving and you're getting feedback, the common theme that I would say, I don't want to say plagued me, but one thing that I continue to work on is I think I have this spirit or undertone of divisiveness. And it's in the spirit of, if you're not part of this one team, one mission, that we are all driving towards this goal line, I really have had to learn how to smooth those edges and struggle with, you know, things that are pulling you off a track. I remember in one executive team meeting, I said to our team, if there were a patient in this room listening to the last 3 hours of our conversation, how would they react to what we're doing to further these products for them, for the patient? And, you know, sometimes things and comments like that are not taken well. And so I think I try to smooth them out in a way that still has courage and, you know, in the spirit of robust dialogue, but isn't maybe as sarcastic or biting as we may have had of KG back in the day.
That's fair. And it's funny, isn't it? Because I also find this with even younger leaders, the appreciation of tone.
Yes.
And, you know, you might be using the same words, but, you know, especially, you know, written form versus vocal form, but even in vocal form, you know, the ability to get your point across without getting someone's backup.
Yes.
I mean, it's much easier to get stuff done if not everybody's just very annoyed with you.
Yes, that's always helpful. And I think, too, there's this undertone of human resources should be that neutral. Nobody should get their backup. You know, again, I think that's why I try to gravitate more to the how can I help, because I think that is the spirit of leading with honey instead of leading with a club.
Sure. I'm sure there are times for a club.
Possibly, yes.
Possibly. So I guess that also kind of takes us to, you know, kind of testing some of this leadership and that sort of thing. So has there been a particular example in your career where, you know, there was a tremendous amount of pressure, or maybe there was a specific situation that you were well and truly the last line of defense, and you were like, okay, well, you know, we've got to dig in and we've got to do this. Otherwise, you know, essentially it's all over. And it would be interesting to see what that was and then how you led the team through that.
Yeah. So when I joined Kite in 2017, the growth of that company was dependent on hiring a number of people in the technical operations space to make sure that the manufacturing capabilities, cell biologists, et cetera, were filling the seats enough so that the company was able to actually commercialize the product. So without people, it would have been and could have been the demise of the business and, again, running towards this approval. And so when I joined, there was a lot of people in place, but we needed more structure. And I think coming in to an already existing team, wondering why now is there, you know, this SVP of HR when we were doing X, Y, and Z in the team, and how is this going to be value add? And so very quickly, I came in. I did SWOT analysis just with the HR team. We talked about, you know, what if we don't do this? And I think very quickly people could see that there was a lot riding on not only the talent acquisition piece, but also making sure that everybody was moving in the direction towards an approval, a launch, et cetera, and the different levers that really sat within our team and the pressures of that. So it was high stress, instant, you know, you hit the ground running. And within that journey, We then took a very sharp left turn with acquisition, and that was a whole, and you know, just another dynamic that we added to that, meanwhile still needing to meet the goals and expectations of hiring cell biologists, et cetera. So it was quite an experience in a very compressed amount of time, which made, I think, that, you know, kind of feeling of pressure cooker. Now, I can sit here and it had a mega happy ending. You know, it was a success. It was great. But right in the throes of it, there's a lot of structure that needs to be formed, relationships that need to be formed, and personalities obviously playing in there with a lot of EQ moments that are needed to get something like that across the line.
Very nice way of putting it, KJ, very subtle as well. I guess the other thing which I would think about is it sounds like there was a leadership shift, maybe in terms of what was needed in order to accomplish the goal. So I know that you've been through a couple of these.
Yes.
Because you've worked at different companies which have just literally exploded in terms of the resources they needed, you know, human resources, financial resources, and all of that side of things. So when you look at maybe a company or a business which is going through its evolution, it's moving from maybe that R&D clinical state into maybe a launch state, maybe it's first product, maybe it's a from first product to multi-product state. How does the leadership which is needed change, and how do you manage that?
You know, there's actually a pretty dramatic shift in leadership that I've seen that's needed during those major block changes of, especially in biotech. So going from preclinical to, for example, a commercial organization, or going even IPO, those events in a company really change the focus, especially for leadership at the executive team level. Because your customers are not internal as much as now they are external. Mm. So obviously in a public world, we have shareholders and that value that the company is creating. But it, you know, it's the investors. It's a lot of people kind of watching at a very, you know, sometimes intrusive level. And I think that if you have leaders that have not led in that, it usually is when you see in a company's evolution a shift. So a lot of companies are really apologetic. Well, you know, gee, we had to get a new CFO. There's usually a point in a company where it's, you know, X company 2.0. And that 2.0 comes when that external pressure is maybe too much for an executive or a leader within the executive team to be able to maintain the technical expertise that they were doing. So, example, somebody was a controller for a 50-person biotech company. They got promoted to the VP of finance, and all of a sudden, the company is now public, their CFO, you've got two marketed drugs on the market, That CFO 2 years ago, who was a controller, is most likely inundated with things that are coming at them that they do not have experience with. And so I think those are things, like I said, like investors, shareholders, even board members that are, you know, always trying to kind of, you know, be a little bit more than advisors and want to help with operations. And so I think it's fairly common. Now, people make those transitions successfully, but that takes development as you're moving towards that. So the faster the rocket ride, sometimes the less time the team has to get prepared for that.
For sure. And I guess that also is interesting, because when you think about team development and things like that, do you feel that sometimes businesses, you know, maybe they miss a trick in terms of, you know, developing leaders internally? And I'd be interesting to know if there were kind of three common things that have come up over your time as you've seen these developments happening And it'd be interesting to see whether we could kind of define those, bring a bit of clarity to those, because it would be nice if people started thinking about them maybe ahead of schedule.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, time is always of the essence, right? I think that leadership development is an evolution, not a revolution. You don't go to one course. Somebody can't be a new leader with now 50 people reporting to them and have the organization assume success. So I think, you know, the more time and the more runway that you have to get people prepared, the downside with that is in biotech, there's a lot of work to be done. So whether you're Series A, B, C, whatever that is, you're normally working on very limited cash, which means very limited resources. And that means you're doing all of the work. And so all of the work usually doesn't raise the leadership development to a priority until we're at a mission critical point. So I think that if it's an actual plan and people can really stick to that plan, that would go a long way. The other thing that, you know, I usually tell people is really great technical people with really great technical skills don't always equate to a phenomenal leader.
Why?
I would say sometimes it could be as simple as IQ versus EQ. Other times it is the want versus need. That person wants to be a part of the technical piece, but the company needs them to be a leader. And I think that is sometimes where you see that leadership model break, is that the individual wants the positional power, also, thanks just great technical skills will continue to get them there. And if you look at, you know, really great scientists, they're like artists, they're like chefs. I mean, it truly is an individual contributor role, that this is what I mean about that time and runway for development, because you actually need more time when somebody has this great technical talent and you actually do want them to lead.
I think it's also very interesting, because I see it a lot in the technical organizations where the shift between, you know, R&D to commercial, there's a point where you've got to stop fiddling with the platform. You know, you've got to be able to take that concept and take it through to launch. And in fact, you know, a number of startups or things like that that I've worked with, their first platform is not necessarily their best platform. It is the platform that gets the job done in order to prove point of concept, in order to get more funding so that we can live to fight another day. And that's being echoed across, you know, development teams, quality teams, and in fact comes back to, I guess, a risk management approach, which I imagine in many ways also comes back to a leadership element, where the leadership team maybe they seem detached or from a front line or things like that, but it may be because they're thinking of things to do with that risk management approach. You know, they're not trying to necessarily create the GT40. You know, they are trying to create something with wheels on that goes around the track.
That's right. That's right. No, that's an accurate statement. Absolutely.
Yeah, good. So in terms of, I guess, reading materials, tools, or when you're, maybe there are these hungry leaders who come to you and say, you know, we're not sure, we can see that maybe there's something coming down the road and we're going to need more skills. Are there things that you kind of steer people towards? Are there kind of either leadership training plans, books, materials, things like that?
Yeah, I'm an avid reader myself, so I don't think anybody would go wrong with any kind of book. I 100% will always endorse someone like Colin Powell, someone like Brené Brown. I think, you know, there are so many different styles out there that you almost have to pick up a few books and see what resonates with you. I think too that, you know, the benefit, if there is one, of COVID and having everyone work remotely, a lot of the leadership development that used to be in person, it was only done in person, is now in a very short amount of time adapted a lot of their platforms to a virtual setting. Sure. And one that, again, I can't speak highly enough of would be Center for Creative Leadership. So they have a brush of products anywhere that goes from your first-time leader and how to get somebody that used to have a bunch of peers that is now a leader into that role as quickly as possible with some of the fundamentals, all the way through people who are running multi-billion dollar organizations and really kind of everything in between. Not all those platforms are done virtually, but at least enough are that you can get some start and get, you know, kind of off the blocks, if you will, to get online training. Some of them are self-paced. So even if, you know, we go back into a world where all of the trainings are live, you could still do those on, you know, the evenings, the weekends, things like that.
Excellent. I think that's, I've not heard about it, so that will be my next stop. Thank you for that, KG.
Yeah.
I think you also mentioned COVID. You know, this year, I think if we all sat down in January and we wrote down what was about to happen over the next 6 months, and we actually, you know, we talked about COVID occurring, we talked about the George Floyd kind of protests and really kind of the recognition that change is needed in so many different areas. You know, a lot of people would have been quite surprised, you know, and probably thought you're a little bit mad, in as much that, you know, all of this is going to happen in 6 months, but here we are and we're dealing with it. I guess it's also very interesting to then kind of look at how work culture has changed. I mean, I know for myself that, you know, I'm on the phone, I would say more, probably more, but then again, I live on a phone, you know, but a lot more kind of Zoom calls, you know, coaching, which used to be organic and natural in an office setting, doesn't exist anymore. So everything's a bit more formalized and things like that. And it's a lot of gear changing during the day. And a lot of senior people that I know are also saying, look, I'm exhausted. I'm more tired than I've ever been. I'm working more hours than I've ever worked. So I guess that brings us to self-management aspects of being a leader. And when you still have responsibilities, they may be home responsibilities, they may be business responsibilities, they may be pastoral responsibilities. How do you balance your energy as a leader, and what has kind of proven to be most effective for you?
Yeah, I think for me personally, you know, I get a lot of energy being around people. So you can imagine what the last 6 months has done, because, you know, it's team meetings and it's this and that. And it is very isolating, I think, for a lot of people during this time of COVID. I think people want to be seen, which is why we're seeing all of these meetings, phone calls, and you're really trying to have a connection with somebody, either one-on-one or in a group environment. What I've been telling our team is all of that is great, but at a certain point, you do have to take a break. So instead of 8 in the morning till 6 at night, call, 10 minutes, let me grab lunch and a quick bio break, I am now a suburban farmer. My neighborhood has a garden. I try to walk over there once a day, look at my crops, take a little break, be outside. And I think that, you know, for me, I've never done something like this before. Again, I live in New York City,
right?
You know, taking refuge in Minneapolis, Minnesota. But I just think that having a break like that, any person, you know, to almost kind of stop and walk outside, there's a little bit of grounding that I think we can all do during the workday. Now, a lot of people love just back to back to back, and I'll be done at 6, and therefore I don't have to think about it anymore. And maybe that's the time to go for a walk, to, you know, do something. But I think the idea to just always have your laptop open, always be available. It just will, to me, just lead to burnout faster than mentally stepping away, taking a break. You know, it used to be a treat, right, for a lot of us to come home and watch Netflix. Now it's like it's the only refuge at 6, 7 o'clock. And so maybe there's something else. But I think that's at least what I try to encourage is just separate, even if it's for 15 minutes. And if it can be outside, all the better.
Sure. And in terms of kind of managing, I guess, yourself and that side of things, how did you identify maybe some of the triggers that maybe you have? And then what do you do about them?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I hear you loud and clear, you know. I mean, I speak to people for a living, so I like people too.
Yeah.
But I'm really, really intrigued about that side of things for you.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, craving that social peace, not having it, you know, the stress that we all feel. Nobody's ever worked in this type of environment. We're all learning together. The kids, for some people around the house, all of that. I think for me, what I notice is if there's a certain point where the sarcasm level or just a bit of the, you know, that shortness is starting to creep in, I will literally force myself to step back and take a break. And again, that could be even a half an hour. And I think what you learn over time of yourself, if you really stop to think about it, is how do I respond to this instead of react? And I think when we all get tired and stressed and crabby and, you know, that type of, you know, and I've been saying to people, let me take tonight. I want to respond to that tomorrow. I don't want to react to that today. And so I think that's been helpful just to kind of work through it in a way that it can be more measured and probably more productive than what my first reaction might be.
That's fantastic. And what a nice little soundbite as well.
There you go.
Respond to that tomorrow. Don't react to that today.
Yes.
That is getting written down. Thank you very much. That's amazing. And I guess, you know, in a non-COVID situation, how did you, I guess, ensure that you were ready to lead each day? Do you have like routines, or is there like little mental, physical, or spiritual kind of tricks that you use to kind of be in that right mindset and be the leader that your team needs you to be?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously, if you don't live or work in New York, you can imagine the hustle and bustle. And for me, there's about a 20-minute commute door to door when, you know, it's a non-COVID world. And so my typical morning routine was, you know, all the stuff at home, and I would grab my smoothie, and my route to the office, whether I walked, subwayed, or took a car service, I always listened to something that was productive. That could be the Oprah Deepak meditation, that could be an audio book, but it was something that was completely separate from, I mean, when I say chaos, again, everyone knows old school New York of just getting from A to B. It was a way to almost just kind of ground. So when I walked into the office, as things are getting thrown at me and I'm being bombarded with questions and what about this, it was, you know, kind of I'm here, present, ready to go. And I think that became, you know, almost started on a whim where somebody said, hey, you know, have you tried these meditations? And I thought, I'm not that girl. But when you start listening, it really separates you, and found it really helped take the time, but also prep for the day.
Sure. And I mean, a lot of people, I think, talk about meditation and things like that. And I've tried, I've had good things. When I started running my own business, I found myself falling asleep an awful lot in the middle of the day. You know, I think, you know, it's definitely something you have to commit to. Do you use that to manage stress as well? Or I guess the other thing is, or are there management techniques that you use for things which are simply outside of your control? Because that's what I find is, you know, there are so many things. And in fact, I'm going through the process of trying to buy a house right now in the middle of a pandemic, which could have picked better timing, I guess. But the simply the things which I can't do anything about drive me loopy. And I quite often have to take myself away and have a very strong chat with myself. So it'd be really interesting to see, you know, what do you have and what have you developed to maybe help with those situations too?
I want to say with age comes wisdom on that one that, you know, I would have said 10 years ago, 15 years ago, like I would get in these death spirals of control issues where it just would start swirling in my head and I wanted to figure it out. And what would they say? And what would my reaction be if they said that? And at a certain point, and I actually don't know when that was, it was almost like I can't control that. And, you know, it wasn't a magical moment. It just is, I think, you know, if people are really getting dialed up about something that they absolutely can't control. I always, like I said, I mean, I've said it earlier, I always tell people, go for a walk and think about it maybe with a different perspective. Mm-hmm. The other thing, too, is a lot of times what I used to say to people in really high stress roles, if you woke up tomorrow and a miracle happened and you had all of these answers, what would that look like? And also, if you woke up tomorrow and every worst possible scenario happened, what would that look like? And it allows people to kind of play through what I'll call the pros and cons. And usually, you know, one wins out. But then it's almost like, okay, I've thought through this. And sometimes that's a way to now move on and get onto the next subject. I think the thing about COVID that's been hard for people is that we don't really have this end game. Maybe it's the vaccine that's kind of out there, but it feels like we're kind of running around the dog track and we're all chasing the bunny. And, you know, some days the bunny seems further away. But I do think, you know, right now that bunny, aka vaccine, is the one thing that it really is keeping people going. So when we see on the news that rates are going up and, you know, those continue to climb, there could be a sense of, oh my gosh, I can't control this. But there's a certain point where you have to step back and it'll figure itself out. And how do you adapt that day, that moment, in kind of what you can control?
Absolutely. And have you ever had to kind of sit down and really define what you can control and what you can't control? Or is that something which, you know, is very natural for you?
I would say it's more natural. I don't think I've ever had that finite, this is in the bucket, that's not in the bucket sort of thing. You know, I think there's a lot of speculation that still happens here and there. And then when you catch yourself, you're like, where's this leading sort of thing? So I think if I can catch myself early, it takes, again, away that, you know, kind of scenario planning that is just sometimes futile.
Sure. And obviously it speaks very highly of self-awareness. You know, understanding yourself seems to be one of the greatest ways to prohibit stress, in as much that if you know what upsets you, triggers you, or something else, well, the rest is much easier and you know how to avoid it, hopefully.
Yeah.
Okay. So if we think about the future and where we are, I think it's very interesting, you know, if we compare leadership now to 30 years ago, 25 years ago. In fact, beginning of our call before we started recording, obviously I was talking about the fact that, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, and you walked into a room and started talking about your feelings with your executive team, I think they probably would have asked you to leave. So, and I feel like leadership has now evolved to a point where a lot of places are trying to nurture the whole human being, not just, you know, a robotic kind of business part or things like that. So when you think about the future, how would you like to see leadership evolve over the next decade?
Yeah, I think it comes back to this idea of a holistic leader. where you're really encompassing the idea of not just the work component, but family and, you know, spiritual and all of the things that come into that. You don't really talk about spirituality at work, but usually if there's a way that maybe an employee can get some tools, and, you know, some might think meditation is spiritual, others might not. They may think of it as a tool for stress release. So I think that where leadership is heading is in this individual environment. When I look back in the day, you know, to the 90s, 2000s, it seemed very canned. You know, do this for 2 years, do that training course, do that for 2 years. And now I think we're starting to identify leaders early that may not have the title, but there's that influence without authority. I think we are identifying how the business needs that mixture of, you know, the up-and-comer, the high-potential, high-performer, as well as the tried-and-true, maybe veteran executive, and a lot of mentorship where it's not lead by example all the time, but, you know, imparting those little pieces of wisdom. And I think having more than one mentor is a great idea because you're learning from so many different people. You know, when you think of all the bosses that you had in your career, you can think of some positive things, even if you didn't enjoy working with them, of what would I want to take away? And if I were a leader, what would I do? And I think we're going to see more of that individual type of development in leadership, more, you know, around EQ instead of around more of a just a core curriculum that you have to check boxes to get to the next level.
Sure. And it's quite interesting because I've got a question written down, which is how will leaders provide the most value as there are increased challenges for talent and resources? And it sounds like that kind of slides very nicely into this kind of area of our discussion, because in many ways, it almost sounds like a leader is a bit of a hub for information and sharing of that experience, a teacher, a coach, a mentor. Can you think of maybe other ways that they're going to be able to drive value to that business in that role as well?
I think a leader for the business is not only a hub, but it's also the circle around all of the people. And it's that lead from the front, general direction. I think the big thing a leader provides is direction and priorities. And then if you can get out of the way and let the team do that, I think it creates this environment of we can conquer the world. Now, there has to be a culture that underpins that of learning from your mistakes. And that, I think, is something different than leadership, because the environment, you know, we're seeing a lot more around psychological safety. And, you know, if people are making mistakes and publicly flogged in front of other people, people aren't going to want to make mistakes. So they're not going to take risks. And I think that really starts impacting not only the culture, but the business. So, again, around this innovate, execute, speed that I spoke of, you're not going to be able to innovate if you don't take some of those risks. And I think that if you're expecting a 100% success rate, people may be disappointed because there has to be some learnings along the way.
Sure. So is there, obviously with your teams, with that kind of mantra of innovation, execute, and speed, I'm sure that there are elements and times where things have just gone sideways rather quickly or rather unexpectedly. So do you have a process that you would take your team through to help them to understand, you know, where things went wrong, almost kind of debug it, as it were, and then say, okay, well, the next time we do this, let's not do those things. So what does that look like?
Yeah. So I come from a military family, and there's something called an AA. It's an after action report, or an AAR. And you literally dissect what was supposed to happen and then what went wrong. And it can be something as simple as, you know, you're building out a new location and things got delayed. Well, what is that going to mean? all the way to maybe something really kind of headed south. And so I think that's a way to formalize, we want to talk about this, memorialize, we want to talk about this, but do that in a safe setting where people feel comfortable to say, yeah, that didn't go well. Because I think if people are blindsided with that, or it starts circulating in emails and 147 people are CC'd, it really turns into more of blame and shame. But if it's in a sure. controlled environment, I think it makes it much more productive.
So within that environment as a leader, how do you give maybe the quietest person in your team a voice? Because I've definitely been part of teams where, and it sounds like I'm quite chatty, but there were far more chatty people than me and far more dominant than me. And I was just like, okay, you know what? I don't need to talk right now. So I would stay quiet and sometimes lose my opportunities. So, you know, as that leader, what are the difficulties that you found maybe giving everybody a voice and actually maybe celebrating that diversity of thought?
One of the things that I like to do when I join a team is do a Myers-Briggs. And if you look at a Myers-Briggs, when someone is an I or an introvert and they're surrounded by a team of E's or extroverts, meaning that the extroverts are thinking out loud and the I's are internalizing, if there's not an agenda for that meeting, whether it's a after action review meeting or maybe it's just a team meeting, that person is going to come to the meeting with a little bit of a disadvantage because they want to internalize what the question is. They want to think about it. They want to process it. Sometimes people will even kind of turn away from the table. If there are times where it feels like there's so much dialogue happening and someone like Alex hasn't said anything, a lot of times I'll say, let's take a 5-minute bio break. And that gives you enough time to think about what was my answer to that. And so when we come back together, a lot of times I'll say, okay, you know, thanks guys for the break. Okay, Alex, we haven't heard from you. What are your thoughts on A, B, and C?
Yeah, fantastic. I think that's it's a really nice, typically subtle move, KG. really, and it's interesting because, you know, as I've got on and found teams and things like that and founded teams and ran teams, I always find that actually if you've got two extroverts, they can almost kind of get into a bit of a dogfight of ideas where they'll push back and forth all the time. And eventually they'll just run out of steam. And then it's normally at that point your introvert speaks. We're normally with something very useful to say.
Oh, it's
as well,
usually profound. Why didn't you say that 20 minutes ago? Yes,
because
that's right.
Because they've been listening and synthesizing.
That's right.
Which then kicks everybody off again. So yeah. I think that actually, you know, there's this beautiful way that introverts can bring huge value to the table without necessarily soapboxing or things like yeah. that. So, yeah, no, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, staying on agenda for an introvert is a godsend because they're able to think through and actually have mentally prepared for what's coming. Instead of if a conversation is spiderwebbing all over, it is a little bit of a disadvantage. And again, I'm generalizing here. It's not, you know, that extreme, but I think it's always helpful to get the best thought out of people. And if we can prepare an environment that, you know, offers that, I think, you know, why wouldn't you? So if that means an agenda and we stick to it, okay, let's put that on the agenda for next week if we want to, you know, add that new topic that came up instead of tackling it right there.
Fantastic. And what I'd like to do now is just running a little close on time. So just a little bit of quick fire questions for you, which are always good fun. So if you were to create a sign to inspire the next generation, what would you put on it?
You know, my tagline, and I always stand by it, is hashtag OTOM, one team, one mission. Like, you know, I just think that next generation, if you look at this as kind of we're all in this together and we're all pulling the rope in the same direction, I do think that, you know, we're all going to get a lot further. So that would be my, you know, think about it as a team instead of as an individual.
Sure. And are there any other key phrases that you've had which have kind of joined you as you've gone through your journey?
I don't think so. Like I said, I think it was probably 5 years back or so that I came up with the OTOM, and it just has absolutely resonated with me, both personally and professionally.
Fantastic. And what would you hope that people will say your legacy will be?
You know, I would hope that it would be, she had a knack of working with and selecting some really great companies that brought some great therapies to patients.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. I think we'd all be very happy with that.
Yes.
Fantastic. And do you have any favorite quotes? And if so, why do they resonate with you? It can also be, you know, maybe just other leaders that you've worked with or maybe who've inspired you and their mantras that have maybe stayed with you as well.
Yeah, I think I've got two answers for that. I think, you know, from a quote standpoint, one quote that I actually have on my wall in New York is, what would you do if you knew you wouldn't fail? And I think this opportunity to take risks, and that could be professional risks, personal risks, I think we're almost kind of conditioned to think the worst, but usually when you get through that, it's not as bad as you maybe thought it would be. So I think it just reminds me personally of, you know, take those risks. And younger listeners, that might be YOLO, but I think that it's kind of the same concept. And then the other side of that question, leaders that I've worked with that, you know, I worked with Lonnie Mulder. Lonnie is Abraxas, Tessara, MGI. He's a phenomenal leader in the biotech world. And one of my first leadership roles in biotech was with Lonnie. And he said a lot and spoke a lot about, you know, the golden rule and treat others the way you would want to be treated. And what most people didn't see was behind the scenes, whether we were talking about terminating an employee, whether we were talking about, you know, just different business opportunities, that actually was how he addressed everything. And obviously, I think that's a testament to his success in biotech, because so many people want to work with Lonnie Mulder. And it is watching him that I think I saw these early days of, you know, kind of practice what you preach. Don't just like the quote or the mantra, but, you know, watching Lonnie in those real world examples and environments where that is how he behaved, it just was an amazing kind of first row seat to what really good leadership looks like.
Could we maybe boil that down into really kind of authentic leadership?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, exactly what you're putting out there is what you do, where your actions effectively match your words.
Yep.
And the decisions and behaviors that you put forth. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a beautiful place to kind of wrap up. So I've got to say, KD, it's always such a pleasure. I feel like I end up learning more from our conversations than anyone else. So thank you so much. And thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, this was phenomenal. Thank you for having me, Alex. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, guys. It's Alex from Phase 3 Research here. I hope you enjoyed the latest episode of the Phase 3 Biotech Leadership Podcast. We'll be back in the next few weeks with a new interview with another world-class leader. Until then, please stay safe, stay motivated, and keep making a difference.